Psalm 50, The Coming Judgment, by Robert C. Newman. Brief abstract. This talk is a sketch of one of the major Bible passages describing the Last Judgment. The psalm begins with God's call of judgment, followed by his judgment of the true people of God, and then by his judgment of the false people of God. Psalm 50 is one of the major passages in the Bible describing what is traditionally called the Last Judgment. Two other passages are Matthew chapter 25 and Revelation chapter 20. Each of these passages has a different perspective and a different emphasis. We will occasionally refer to these other two passages as well as Psalm 50. So, let's begin. The psalm starts with a call to judgment in verses 1 through 6. And it reads this way in the NIV. The Mighty One, God the Lord, speaks and summons the earth from the rising of the sun to the place where it sets. From Zion, perfect in beauty, God shines forth. Our God comes and will not be silent. A fire devours before him, and around him a tempest rages. He summons the heavens above and the earth that he may judge his people. Gather to me my consecrated ones who made a covenant with me by sacrifice. And the heavens proclaim his righteousness, for God himself is judge. So, God comes. He comes in majesty. We see references to God as the Mighty One. We see him shining forth in verse 2. We see the fire and the tempest. The fire devours before him. Around him a tempest rages. He comes to summon all the earth. The Mighty One God, the Lord, speaks and summons the earth, verse 1. Verse 4, he summons the heavens above and the earth that he may judge his people. He summons the earth from the rising of the sun to the place where it sets from east to west. God comes to speak and not to remain silent. So he speaks and summons the earth in verse 1. And verse 3, our God comes and will not be silent. This picks up a theme that shows up in verse 21 that we'll notice later when we get to that place. He comes to judge those who claim to be his, verses 4 and 5. Gather to me my consecrated ones who have made a covenant with me by sacrifice. Whether or not these are really his people, or whether they only claim to be his people. And the question, judging those who really are his people, will take place in verses 7 through 15, and those who are not in verses 16 through 21. And God comes to vindicate his own actions. The heavens will proclaim his righteousness, verse 6. So, the call to judgment. This judgment, then, is split into two pieces. The first verses, verses 7 through 15, are judgment of the true people of God. And then verses 16 through 21 or 23 are the judgment of the false people of God. Let's look at the first part. We'll need a couple panels to cover this. Verse 7 and following, Hear, O my people, and I will speak, O Israel, and I will testify against you. I am God, your God. I do not rebuke you for your sacrifices or your burnt offerings, which are ever before me. I have no need of a bull from your stall or of goats from your pens, for every animal of the forest is mine, and the cattle on a thousand hills. I know every bird in the mountains, and the creatures of the field are mine. If I were hungry, I would not tell you, for the world is mine and all that is in it. Do I eat the flesh of bulls or drink the blood of goats? Sacrifice thank offerings to God. Fulfill your vows to the Most High, and call upon me in the day of trouble. I will deliver you, and you will honor me. So, first of all, God speaks to those who are really his, and we can compare this with Matthew 25 judgment passage, where Jesus speaks first to the sheep, and then the goats, the sheep representing his people, and the goats representing those who are not his. The emphasis here in our judgment passage is on the shortcomings of God's people, whereas in Matthew 25, The emphasis is on the faithfulness, and in Revelation 20, the emphasis is on their redemption, their names being written in the Book of Life. We find that one of their shortcomings, or the two of their shortcomings, if you like, or categorization of their shortcomings, is that they have a poor view of God and an inflated view of their own faithfulness, verses 8 through 13. They have been faithful in sacrifices, but they apparently think they're doing God a favor in serving him. God's response is that God does not need our sacrifices. He created and owns everything. If he needed anything, he wouldn't ask us. And he doesn't need meat or drink anyway. So then, what is the purpose of sacrifice? Verses 14 and 15, we're told that it's intended to remind us of our need for God and of God's faithfulness to us. Note the particular offerings mentioned here. There are thank offerings and vow offerings. That is, the offerings in which we are thanking God for what he's done, how he has answered our prayers. And God wants us to keep on calling for his help, and he will keep on rescuing us. So we'll see some insight into how the people of God back in Old Testament times and in New Testament times and in church history, etc., have tended to think too highly of themselves and too lowly of God, to think that somehow in our faithful service to him, we're doing him a favor. Even though Jesus has said, when you've done all that's required of you, you should say, we are unprofitable servants. We have only done what it was our duty to do. And you're seeing that picture here as well. And yet, God wants us to be thankful to him. He wants us to keep crying out to him for help. And he will keep on rescuing us, because that's the kind of God he is. Now, in verses 16 through 23, we turn to the judgment of the false people of God. And the NIV reads this way, starting in verse 16. But to the wicked, God says, what right have you to recite my laws or take my covenant on your lips? You hate my instruction and cast my words behind you. When you see a thief, you join with him. You throw in your lot with adulterers. You use your mouth for evil and harness your tongue to deceit. You speak continually against your brother and slander your own mother's son. These things you've done, and I kept silent. You thought I was altogether like you, but I will rebuke you and accuse you to your face. Consider this, you who forget God, or I will tear you to pieces with none to rescue. He who sacrifices thank offerings honors me, and he prepares a way so that I may show him the salvation of God. So what do we see here? Well, El-God turns to those wicked people who claim to be his, and this is a somewhat narrower perspective than in the other two judgment passages of Matthew 25 and Revelation 20, which include, on the bedside, those who don't claim to be his, as well as those who do. The emphasis here in Psalm 50 is on the incongruity of these people claiming to be God's people, whereas the emphasis in Matthew 25 for the wicked is on their unfaithfulness, and in Revelation 20 the emphasis is on their not being redeemed, their not being written in the Lamb's, their names not being written in the Lamb's Book of Life. Well, the judgment of the false people of God can be characterized in many ways as the same as that of the true people of God. They too have a poor view of God and an inflated view of their own faithfulness. J.B. Phillips was right when he titled one of his books, Your God is Too Small, because that's true of every last person who's ever been created, that we tend to have too small a view of what God is really like. And we have a tendency to have an inflated view of our own faithfulness. A psych professor at Hope College some years ago wrote a very nice book called The Inflated Self. So, The judgment on the false people of God is in this sense similar to that on the true people of God. Each has a poor view of God and an inflated view of one's own faithfulness. But now God asks, what right have they to recite God's law and apply his covenant to themselves? So they are speaking as though they have the benefit of this covenant, but their actions show where their heart really is. And so God here says in Psalm 50 that they hate God's law, that they sympathize with sinners, and that their mouths reveal the real status of their hearts. It goes like this, verse 17, you hate my instruction and cast my words behind you. When you see a thief, you join with him and throw in your lot with adulterers. You use your mouth for evil and harness your tongue to deceit. You speak continually against your brother and slander your own mother's son. So their actions show where their heart really is. Continuing on under this theme of a poor view of God, an inflated view of one's own selfish faithfulness, they misread the silence of God. I kept silent, and you thought I was just like you. They think God's silence means his approval, but they're mistaken. And they will be surprised by God's judgment. Well, why do we have this picture of the judgment in Psalm 50? God is telling us this ahead of time so that we can do something about it now. Now, that is surely a major purpose in biblical materials like the blessing and curse passages in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, and here in this Psalm 50, and in Matthew 25, and in Revelation 20. Lastly, we learn something about the purpose of sacrifice under the judgment of the false people of God as well. The emphasis here on sacrifice in these two put us back in the Old Testament context, and sacrifice would, of course, been a characteristic of what would be thought to be a major worship activity, and so a major good work, if you like. Well, here we're told that thank offerings honor God, that they remind us of who God is. So, he who sacrifices thank offerings honors me, okay? Remind us of who he is, because they remind us that he's the prayer-answering God. He's the God that we can call on, and he will rescue us, okay? That we're the ones that depend on him, not he the one who depends on us, as we see in some of the pagan literature of antiquity, thinking of the Babylonian flood story. It's that Gilgamesh epic, I believe is the name of it, in which the gods flock around the offerings that Gilgamesh makes when he gets off the ark, if you like. And the purpose of sacrifice, then, is to remind us who God is, not the one who needs us, but we're the one who needs him, etc. And they open the way for people to experience God's salvation. The psalmist does not explain this to us, but I think we can figure out part of it, at least, from what we said already, that for us to experience God's salvation, we have some need to know something about who he is. We're never in this life going to know him fully as he is, and probably being finite creatures, we'll never, even in eternity, know him fully as he is. We're also in this life going to see that we need him very, very much. And the only way for us to experience God's salvation is to recognize our need for him and cast ourselves upon him realize that we have to trust him. If we don't trust him, we will make a complete mess of our lives. So thank offerings remind us of who God is. They honor him, and they open the way for people to experience God's salvation. Since we do not in our period now, since the temple has been destroyed, do not, in fact, give thank offerings, if you like, in the way that the Israelites did in old times. We might say thankfulness honors God and reminds us of who He is and opens a way for us to experience God's salvation. Well, that's the end of a rather quick tour of Psalm 50. And my question to each one of us is, am I ready? Are you ready for the judgment? And suggestions here on what is involved in getting ready for the judgment is to examine our own hearts and to see whether we hate God's law, whether we sympathize with sinners, meaning their lifestyle, not a desire to see them saved, and whether we are thinking too highly of ourselves in how we have sacrificed to serve the Lord, etc., and forgotten that God wants us to honor Him by depending upon Him and calling out to Him and seeing Him rescue us. Are we ready for the judgment? May the Lord grant that we will be ready for the judgment. Well, thanks for your attention, and good night.